have a cell phone as my extension number. I answer it on the weekends. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about, honestly, what's going to be the most pressing issue for us. New World Screw-Em's been in the news a lot, but I don't really anticipate it being a problem. I'm still very hopeful that we'll get it under control and it's going to become a non-issue. However, Asian longhorn tick and Tularia orientalis is in Kansas and it's causing significant issues. So we're going to spend most of our time chatting about that. So this tick is unlike any other tick that we have had or will ever have. And basically in 2017 is when we started getting our first reports here on the East Coast. That's not all that long ago. If you think about a tick, this isn't an individual that flies, and it's moved westward at quite a rapid pace. Last year, we added 3 new states to the list of states that have confirmed infestations, right? So it is a notable problem. Late last year, we got our first report of it. It had actually been collected over the summer. It's just by the time the KDA got to identifying it, it was towards the end of the year. What for me as an entomologist makes me concerned is that it came off of a dog that had no known travel history, right? If this was a dog that had gone to Missouri and spent some time in Missouri, came back home and they found a tick, I would be less concerned because Missouri's had it for a while. This dog had no travel history. And the second thing is that was a larva tick, and you guys all know how small those teeny tiny seed ticks are, right? The fact that we had a larval tick means we have an adult somewhere. And because we have an adult, that's surely not the only larval tick. And so what makes this tick different and fascinating is whereas every other tick that we have here in the United States, you need an adult male finding an adult female on the same animal. And so if you think about it, your chances as a tick, what are the chances of you climbing onto the same animal as your lifelong partner? And what are the chances if you climbed on at the head and it climbed on at the tail that you guys are magically gonna find each other, right? So a lot of the ticks that climb onto animals just don't find a mate, and so they just are dead ends and they don't get to lay eggs. Our Asian longhorn tick, every tick is a female. So you know how we have aphids that can reproduce without mating? Same thing here. Every single Asian longhorn tick, for all practical purposes, is a female. She doesn't need to mate, which means that she will produce 1,000 clones of herself. None of those need to mate. They will also produce 1,000 clones of themselves. And so you get this really, really massive explosive potential. They also have a very wide host range. They will feed on wildlife. They will feed on birds. They will feed on people. They will feed on dogs. They will feed on anything. They love livestock, but they're not picky, which means that with this wide host range and the fact that you only need one tick to be introduced, you can go from uninfested to infested pretty quickly. And this is important because everybody's gut reaction when they get this tick is, how do I get rid of it? We need to think about not how do we get rid of it, but how do I maintain my populations at a fairly manageable level? And so when our first introductions took place, some very, very clever people at K-State, but I'm a little bit biased, they took the known distribution in other parts of the world, because this is a global tick, and they mapped US climate and said, okay, across the whole United States, where is this tick most likely to survive? And basically what we have is anywhere where it's red, that's prime territory. Darker orange is pretty good, and then lighter orange is, it could probably be there, but the models don't necessarily agree. So for us, eastern half of Kansas is going to probably be a place where this tick will establish itself, which is everybody, anytime I give this talk, they're like, oh, can I be in this part? Right? No tick. If there is no tick, I don't have a problem. We have been talking about this as a tick-borne pathogen since 2017. It is not just a tick-borne pathogen. It has multiple other ways which it can get around. We know that biting lice, the ones that suck the blood, can transmit it, right? And this is primarily an issue on our younger cattle. If you have them bumping up against each other, somebody's got lice and they're infected, they can pass it on to somebody else. We also have transplacental transmission. It's fairly low, probably less than 2%, but it can happen, which means that if you have an infected dam, she can pass it on to her calf. Needle transfer, right? If you're doing a bleed and you use that same needle in another animal, you can move it from animal to animal. Now, the more blood you transfer, the worse the outcome is. How much this actually plays a role in what we see in the field practically, we don't know. And then some preliminary evidence from my lab, we've got lots and lots of cases where the tick is not present, but we have within animal transmission. So there's another way that it's getting around, and we're finalizing up the reports now, but we found Tularia orientalis in the mouth parts of stable flies. And so we think that stable flies and any other biting flies, same way as this happens with anaplasmosis, it can move it from animal to animal. And I don't know how about you guys last year, but flies were pretty bad, right? We're pretty warm this year, which means that if we keep like this, we're gonna have a long, long, long summer. And so good news is that where we've had herds, where we've seen transmission, but the tick isn't there, we don't see clinical disease. So I actually think in this case, the flies are doing us a favor. So we may want to think about that next time we try and kill them. How do you know if you have it? It's a little brown job. It looks like all our other little brown jobs. So it's not like the Lone Star tick that has this very nice white spot on it. You are just going to see a brown tick. They're the same size as all of our other brown ticks. If at any point you collect some brown ticks and you are like, oh no, I don't know what this is, send them to me. I will identify any ticks you send to me. I will even come pick them up if you want. What we have seen is that for the most part, infestations go unnoticed because they kind of trickle along at a low level. And it's only when a producer sees, hang on, this is way more ticks than I usually get, that we think that there is something wrong. And this is kind of what it looks like. This was the big outbreak that happened in Iowa. There's like 70 ticks just on the stem of grass alone, right? So astronomically high numbers of ticks. You will walk out and you will just be covered in ticks. Like, you know when you walk through one of those little larval patches when you have all the seed ticks on you? It's like that, but big ticks. So if you ever see that, that's a pretty clear indication that something's wrong. We also see it on our animals. So this is that same outbreak, and you can, I don't know if you can see terribly clearly, but we've got ticks all here in the tail, all along the side of the legs, in the ear. This over here in the sort of the armpit region, we really worry about this because this is in an area where you get a lot of chafing and then we get bleeding. It's a wound. If New World screwworm does come in, we're worried about things like this. And then you see it up here on this tail head. Then we have two pictures of it on a heifer. And you can see, I mean, just look at all these. This, I think, is actually a cow. And so, as you can imagine, if she's nursing and she's got all these ticks on her, she's not gonna be happy about that calf nursing, right? This is very, very painful. And we can see reduction in milk output. And then this is it on the dewlap. So if you see anything crazy like this, give me a call. This is typically what we see in a infestation. We have some breeds that are gonna be harder to spot than others, right? If you have anybody who is particularly hairy, you're not necessarily gonna see the ticks. And so just keep an eye out on animal scratching, right? Are they rubbing up on things? Are they scratching? Are they looking generally miserable and lethargic? And like I said, send me your ticks. I'm the only person in the world who's happy to have ticks, so make use of it. So these are some things that we, just general good tick control, but especially if you have a situation where the pasture is infested. Honestly, burning is one of the most effective methods of tick control. We did research that showed you can significantly reduce your tick numbers just by pasture burning. Now, there's a few caveats, right? Because sometimes people will say, oh, I burnt and my ticks were worse. There's a specific way you have to burn for ticks. So, number one, burning in the spring is most effective because all the ticks are still hanging out in the grass. If you wait for things to warm up, and honestly, this is too warm, right? We will have tick activity at this level. Once they've emerged out, they're climbing on animals, and so unless you're burning all the squirrels and the bunnies and things like that in your own livestock, you've already produced a new generation. So you want to get it before the ticks emerge out. The other thing that is very, very important is that it doesn't always necessarily, while spring is most effective, if you've got a particularly wet area that is green in spring but dries out, you want to get as much burn coverage as possible. So if that is in late fall, then that is preferable to getting an incomplete burn, especially around our areas like our waterways, right? Because those are green areas, they don't carry the fire, and then what happens is the moment you have these little green patches, the cattle go right into it. And so when you're burning for ticks, it's not like a global thing. You will only have an effect where that grass is burnt. So even if, from me to Lindsay, right, if I'm a burnt area and she's unburnt, those ticks won't cross over. But if any cattle go into that area, they're going to pick up those ticks. So you want to make sure you get a really good burn, especially into tree lines and around waterways. This is these eastern red cedars. They've got to go. They've got to go for a number of reasons. I was driving to a dairy day, and we were fine. And then there was like this fence line, and there was just eastern red cedars everywhere, right? They're a problem for woody encroachment, but also they pull up a lot of water from the ground, and they give off that water in terms of water vapor from the leaves. An insect's number one problem in life is drying out. And so when we go tick collecting, I look for the closest red cedar and I go right there because it's nice and humid. So we're supporting ticks, we're supporting mosquitoes, we're supporting midges. So any of our things that we worry about in terms of transmission of pathogens. So that, and also animals love sticking their butts into it, right? So you have this hot spot where there's lots of ticks, animals are going straight in there. And again, remember, Asian longhorn tick, if you give one of those a meal, your next population is set for the following year. So we really want to do that. This is something that depends on your location, right? If it's a backyard, sure, maybe you can mow it. There are other places across the country, and this is why I keep it in, where they have flat stuff and they don't have rocky ground and they can take a mow to it. If you cut the grass down short, it exposes it to sun, dries it out, ticks are less happy. And then this is something that not everybody has the luxury of, but if you can, this is probably one of the most effective ways, I think, that we can sort of slow that population down, and that's rotation. So this is a picture I took from that Iowa outbreak. This is where we had sort of 70 ticks on each blade of grass, absolutely high infestations. This pasture here is the same person owns both of these pieces, but he rents this one out. He had his own cattle on this, and he pulled them off immediately once the outbreak happened. And this over here, we have just trees and no cattle is on here. In this, even though we had great habitat, lots of trees, we have very, very low numbers of the occasional rabbit or maybe a white-tailed deer. So we had normal tick distribution and honestly very few ticks. This, we couldn't find any ticks at all because it was just straight pasture. There wasn't even a tree. Here, where we had the trees and we had a lot of animals, we just had tons of ticks. So if you can pull cattle off that infested pasture for a year, just take that buffet away so that she can't eat, because a tick, a female tick, will lay as many eggs as the size of blood meal she takes. So if she gets a nice big blood meal, she'll lay more eggs. So if you just reduce that option, your population will go down. Do not spray. I don't want you to waste your money on spraying. In this big Iowa outbreak, the guy, I love him to bits. He is just such a cool guy. Anyway, he has his own plane, so he cropped us. We have time, so I'm gonna tell you the story. He bled cattle for me because we wanted to see how many of his cattle were infected with Talia orientalis. And so he bled it to me and he was like, okay, well, depending on the weather, I'll either ship it to you or I'll bring it to you directly. Now, he's in Iowa. And I'm like, by the time you drive down and stuff, I'm like, UPS can get it to me. And by the way, it's not that fun. He's like, no, I'll just bring it in my plane. He hopped on his plane, flew his plane here, brought us the samples, and then flew back. So anyway, he has a plane. And so his solution was, he was like, I'm going to just spray that pasture. And I said, well, I don't think it's going to work. And he says, well, I've got to do something. So I said, okay, if you're going to spray it, let's cut the grass short first, and then we can spray it. We'll see how it works. Called him about a month later. I said, how did that spraying work? He said, it didn't work at all. Right? So it is very expensive, especially if you don't have your own plane. The reason why it's so ineffective is, so you see here, here's a tick on this blade of grass. A tick spends most of its time resting in the thatch. When it's like, okay, I think there's somebody to eat, it will go up and look for something to eat. When you're spraying, you're only hitting this tick over here. You're not hitting anybody who is in the thatch, which means that it's a high amount of insecticide, you're killing off all your beneficial insects, and you're really not doing anything worthwhile. I got a text from him yesterday, and he's like, okay, we're gonna burn. Can I burn yet? And I said, is it dry? He's like, yep, we're very dry. I said, burn away. So just don't spray. Okay, so that's in the pasture. Then you've got your on animal control. Now, this is really important, right? Because this is actually where we have the most control is our animals. But I want to make sure that, especially if this comes into your herd, that you don't panic. We saw this a lot in Iowa. It came in, people were panicking, and they were making decisions, not based on what their herd had, but just out of fear, which compromised them in the long run. Because our horn flies and our stable flies are going to cause us more loss every single year than Tularia ever will. We also have potentially, I don't think it's going to necessarily happen, but there is this threat of the New World screwworm invasion. And one of the only treatments we have for that is an ivermectin. And so we don't want to be using that too much because it's going to result in fewer options if that comes through. So what I want us to do, how many of you have a good fly rotation strategy for your chemicals? This is a stand, anytime, nobody's like, nobody. How many of you used what you used last year because it seemed to work? Or use what you already have because there's half a bottle left, right? Kansas has some of the most insecticide resistant flies in the nation. My colleagues are always doing studies and like, hey, can we have flies from Kansas? I'm like, you sure can. And I send them their flies. And they're like, oh, this brand new product that has never been used in flies before, and it kills most of the other flies in other states, and Kansas is like, nah, less than 10% of the flies are dead, right? Our flies are resistant to things they haven't seen. So what we should be doing is having a good insecticide rotation strategy. If you need help with this, give me a call. We will walk through whether you use sprays or dips or whatever you want to use, if you want to use a poron, if you want to use tags, how we can do it. I normally like a two-year organophosphate rotation and then the third year a pyrethroid. Your other option is to do an organophosphate followed by a pyrethroid followed by a macrocyclactone. Now the problem is the companies don't make this easy for you, right? You go to the tractor supply store and there's a product label and there's this long thing and you're like, I don't know which one this is and I don't have my phone and I can't even read it. And how am I supposed to type it into Google to find what it is? That's why I say, you need help. Reach out to me. We are starting to develop resources so that we can send out a list and say, look, these are all the products in this group, these are all the products in that group, these are all the products. Hopefully we get some funding to do that. Okay, so ear tags are very popular here in Kansas, not as much in some other states. An ear tag's only going to work if you've got ears, ticks in the ear. So the way an ear tag works is the insecticide is bound to the plastic, and then as the plastic comes into contact with the skin, it moves across. This is why we can use it for horn flies, right? Because they're throwing their heads back. So it's only going to work for a tick that's in the ear. Just another fun fact, tag both ears. I know it's more expensive, but if you only tag one ear, you're only covering half the animal with insecticide. So you want to tag both ears. The most effective option is really spraying, because then you can spray the whole animal. And if you can't, if you don't have a fancy sprayer like this, this type of thing is amazing. But if you don't have that, a hand sprayer will also work. Just any way that you can coat the whole animal with the insecticide. Poron's the one that people go for most readily because it's easy. I get it, right? You can just pour it along the back line. The problem is what we learned in the Iowa outbreak, at least, is if you are using a pyrethroid poron, like your silencers and stuff like that, it doesn't extend over the whole animal. So we killed the ticks along the back, but those ticks that were in the udder or on the tail or on the dewlap didn't touch those. So you'll be applying a product, but it's not going to be beneficial for this tick species. here is where we can use our macrocyclic lactones, you know, Ivermex and things like that. These get absorbed into the body, and so it's available for any tick feeding on the animal. The problem is that it's there's a few issues with resistance and some long-term issues. Only use this if you have a really, really high infestation. Do not use this. If you've got one or two longhorn ticks, don't worry about it. This is like if you have those animals that have thousands and thousands and thousands of ticks on them. Always get a good weight and pour along the whole length of the back of the animal. The reason why I hesitate to use this is, and we had this in Iowa where people were worried, and so they gave shots of ivermectin and things like that. If you do a pour on ivermectin or a shot, once it's in that animal, you can't take it out. An ear tag, I can take out. Something that's on the animal's hair, theoretically, I can wash out. But what happens is the ivermectin goes into the body and it binds to the fat and then it gets released over time, which is nice because you get an extended coverage, theoretically. But if your concentration starts up here, right, over time, it goes down to nothing. There's a long period of time where that concentration is too low to kill an insect, but it's getting exposure to it. And so we're driving that insecticide resistance. The other issue is our poor little dung beetles. Ivermectin kills adult dung beetles and larva dung beetles. And we really have killed our populations, and they're very hard to bring back. And they're about the only hope we have as insecticide resistance gets worse. So avoid, just if we take one thing away from this, do not use an injectable ivermectin. If you have long range, you throw it away, dispose of it correctly. That's the resistance for that, and nematodes is really, really bad. The good news is if you have an infestation, the cattle will naturally develop resistance over time, right? Our older animals especially, this is a picture of ticks that got, this animal had never seen ticks before and this animal had seen ticks before. As the animal develops a resistance, your ticks get smaller and few of them feed. So sometimes you can just let it play it out. I spoke to somebody, they had a really bad infestation, they were on the East Coast. She said they hit it with long range for 2 years, didn't work, and now they can't use ivermectin as a dewormer. They've got complete resistance against ivermectins. That's their first problem. Their second problem is, and so she said then eventually they just left it alone, and she said sort of 3 years later her tick problems are back down to normal levels. Sometimes we just have to give something time to sort itself out.
How do they become resistant to it?
My favorite thing. So, the body has an amazing ability to recognize self and non-self. And so when the tick feeds, it's pumping in all sorts of molecules to make sure that the blood keeps flowing so that there's no pain and itch responses and things like that. These molecules get detected by immune response, and our immune response says, oh, this is something that's not me. I'm going to make a weaponry against it. And then when the tick feeds again, then the body's like, oh, here's this thing. I've encountered it before. It's again? Okay, we're going to boost this. And each exposure, that immune response gets better and better and better. And so what happens is all these jobs that the immune response does is it basically cuts off blood supply. So when a tick is at that area, one of its most important jobs, because it feeds for like 7 days each stage, it has to make sure that that blood keeps flowing. And so the body recognizes all these molecules that it has to keep the blood flowing and says, nope, I'm blocking that and I'm blocking the next thing. And so the tick, they just can't feed. And so you won't be able to see it here, but there's a lot of sort of light red ticks and white ticks. These are ticks that didn't get any blood. They pulled up serum, but they didn't pull up blood, which means they just can't even molt to the next stage. Teach a whole course on that. Okay, so why we really care about this, most people don't get massive infestations, right? Most people get a regular number of ticks and we carry on going like nothing's happened. The reason why we care about it is because of tularemia. And tularemia is generally very interesting from a disease perspective, but what we tend to have is we tend to have an initial outbreak and then we go to something that we call endemic stability. We have endemic stability with anaplasmosis, right? Most cattle have anaplasmosis, they get it, We have low levels of disease. Sure, one or two of them maybe have severe disease, but for the most part, animals get it and they're quite fine. So the problem is that right now we're in this stage for a lot of us. When we are in this stage, all animals are at risk. So whether it's an old animal or a young animal, if it's never seen it before, it is at risk. We have the most severe disease symptoms, and we can have really high mortality rates, right? We can have 20 to 50% mortality rates. We've been in Kansas around the 20% mortality rate, at least for our high-risk animals. So what does this look like? So this is this Iowa outbreak. This group here is a group of cattle that were bred in Wyoming, moved into Iowa on that pasture I told you had so many ticks, right? We have thousands and thousands. We honestly just stopped collecting. We're like, this is too many ticks. And so you can see we have 100% of these cattle infested. Here we had a 20% mortality rate, right? These animals were 2 years old. They got there. Nobody had ever seen it before. They got super infested with infected ticks. So it was really, really bad. Now, over time, you move away from these outbreak areas and you move to what we call endemic stability. When you have this, your younger animals, pre-weaning, are your highest risk, right? These are the ones that are most likely going to show disease symptoms. Our mature animals, we don't have any disease symptoms and we have relatively low mortality. And the problem is that everybody worries about this stage, but realistically, this is the herd that we had the outbreak in. When we went and looked at pastures and herds surrounding that area that were native Iowa animals that had been there for years, we have the same infection rate. And there was no history of disease, right? So most of us are honestly here without realizing it. This guy, Bill, was so convinced. He's like, are you sure your test's working properly? I'm like, no, I'm sure it's working properly. Like, we triple checked. We were even surprised by this. Most people are here and they don't even realize it. This is the exception, right? So there's a lot of fear around it because what makes the news is the producer who lost 20% of his herd. But realistically, that's not what happens. Okay, you can always move to an outbreak zone. We always want to keep a careful note of any naive animals moving into an area, any animals who are high stress. Once these animals are infected, they're infected for life. And so if you brought in stock of cattle and they came from the East Coast and those animals are all infected and you hit bad weather and they have some other health issues, you can have a relapse, right? So you can receive cattle from an infested area and have high mortality rates. You can receive from the exact same location and there's good weather and everybody's low stress and you have no issues. And this is the wild card in this. Okay, so the big thing is this, it's gonna look different whether you're looking at young animals or old animals. So I want you to take note of this because everything you look at, all the fact sheets are gonna tell you about anemia. Anemia is so far later. Once the animal is anemic, this animal may not recover. In our mature animals, so our cows, our bulls, our things like that, I want you to pay attention for loss of appetite. At Tyleria, the first thing that's gonna happen is an animal that previously was a very good doer, eats no problem, goes off food. So that is the first thing you're gonna look out for. They will also drop weight pretty quickly. They're also exercise intolerant. So compared to anaplasma, where animals can get a bit aggressive, these animals are down, dejected, they don't want to get up, they don't want to move. We have had animals just drop dead anytime you got them up to move them. You can also see coughing, the heads hanging, labored breathing, and late stage abortions. You can see this anemia later on, but really this for me is late end stage of the disease. If you can pay attention to these initial critical signs, you've got a stronger chance of getting the animal through. It's going to look like anaplasma that doesn't respond to treatment. In a younger animal, it's going to look like pneumonia that doesn't respond to treatment. So they present slightly differently. Our animals, they're going to have snotty noses. They're going to look dejected. They're also primarily going to go off feed. So you're going to think this animal has a respiratory issue. You're going to hit it with some antibiotics. Nothing happens. You might hit it again. Still nothing happens. So again, keep a note of those respiratory looking things. There's no antitilarial drug available yet. They are, was there a question?
Are these a bacteria, a virus, a parasite?
Protozoa, parasite, yeah, yeah. So it's the first protozoa that we've had in livestock. That's, you know, it's been around other places, but we're used to things that are antibacterial, well, bacterial or viral. This one's a protozoa. And so because it's the first time, there's very few drug treatments. There's only one drug available across the whole world, and we don't have it licensed for use here. Merck is applying for special permission so that we can use it, so I'm hopeful for that. What we have learned, and if you have an outbreak, just call me, right? Because the more information we can get, the better. If you can keep those animals eating, they tend to do better. There's a big inflammatory response with this disease, and when animals go off food, there's another inflammatory response, so we don't want them having to deal with more things than they need. So if you can, doesn't matter what you throw at them, throw the most palatable thing you can find. If you can keep them, eat them, they normally do okay. Have a good relationship with your veterinarian. Some of the drugs that anecdotally we know may help out are prescription only, right? And so you don't want to call your vet and he's like, hey, yeah, but you didn't pay your bill last time. You're like, well, I've got this animal down. Well, pay your bill first, right? So pay your vets and have a good relationship with them. Oh, my vet makes so much money. I've got very high maintenance animals. So steroids may reduce inflammation and this misdirected immune response, but Banamine is something that we've seen is pretty effective. It's like us taking a painkiller, right? It reduces the fever and it reduces the pain. So they generally feel a little bit better, which means they start eating, which means we can get them back onto the road of recovery. Be careful. I speak to some people and they're like, oh, I vaccinated with this thing and I haven't had an issue since. Sometimes there's things that happen in time together that aren't necessarily related, right? So always keep track of things and your observations. The biggest issue that we've had with this is people responses. I don't want the tick, keep it out. Or I have the tick, how do I get rid of it? Or I'm not bringing infected animals in. The number of times people have said, I'm not bringing infected animals in, and I ask them, have you checked your own herd? And they're like, I don't have it, I don't have disease. And I say, check your herd. And they check their herd and they already have it, right? So resist the urge if an animal is positive. It doesn't mean that you don't necessarily want to bring it in, especially if it's otherwise a great animal that you would like to have in your herd. We want to be vigilant, like keep an eye out for things, but we don't need to panic. This is something that is manageable. Give me a call, we can walk through it. And mostly buy and sell cattle as usual. Resist the urge not to purchase cattle. A lot of people are saying, oh, well, I'm not going to buy cattle out of the East Coast anymore. This is eventually going to become a national problem, right? If anything, we want to get it into our herds and stabilized as fast as possible. I hate telling people to spend money. I try and avoid making people spend money at any cost. But what I would say, test your herds. If you don't know what you have, you don't know how to manage it, right? So if you have a smaller herd, there's no magic number. If you've got a smaller herd, test as many and as many animals as you feel comfortable spending that money on. When you have a small group, if you test a small number of a small group, there's a higher chance that you miss it. If an animal tests positive, you never have to test that animal again. It will be a carrier for life. If it's a larger herd, test about 10 to 20% of the herd. If you know that your herd is negative, then if you want to bring a positive animal in, we can manage that introduction. If your herd is positive, you need to know that because any negative animals coming in are at risk. So number one is just knowing what you have. And always test new animals coming into the herd if you do have a positive herd. Any questions before we move on?
Are they carriers of anaphylaxis at all, like other
ticks? It's a different tick. But you can be co-infected with Anaplasma and Tularia.
I understand. Are they known not to be carriers compared to ticks?
This tick?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Doesn't transmit Anaplasma.
No.
Thankfully, we only have to worry. We don't need any more, right? So completely different transmissions.
Okay.
Tick-based, both can go by fly, but ticks-wise, different. But we can have it in the same animal, and we're doing a project now that's looking at co-infection with Tularia and Anaplasma. How does it affect calf performance, right? If the cow is infected with one or both, Does she have lighter calves? Do they grow as well? Things like that. Because there is a loss of production, at least in acute disease, for Tularia. But once they recover, and any animal that doesn't show any symptoms of infection has no difference in production, which is really interesting, right? So you can have a herd that is endemically stable and it's not going to impact production in any way, shape, or form, which is comforting, at least. Any other questions? Okay, so we're going to move on to New World screwworm, which everybody's scared about right now because it's been in the media a lot. And the media is so clickbaity. They're always using these titles like a man-eating screwworm. And there's a picture about it, how it's going to death. There's I think it was the Atlantic or something. They had this weird picture of cows and it looked all disjointed. And it's like it's going to decimate the livestock industry, right? The problem is, number one, it's very clickbaity and it's making us very panicked. So when people are panicked, they don't make good decisions. The other problem is that the media gets it wrong a lot. I am collecting all the times where I have somebody talking about New World screwworm. Like here's talking about the New World screwworm. Here's talking about New World screwworm. Here we go. Each one of these are flies that are not the New World screwworm. And why this is important is because when people are like this, and they're like, oh, but wait, I saw this fly in my kitchen earlier. Oh no, do I have New World screwworm? Right? That is not the New World screwworm. This is the New World screwworm over here. Now, the other problem is we have the Old World screwworm. And the Old World screwworm looks identical to the New World screwworm. So, even if you see something that is blue and metallic and orange eyes, chances are it's actually a Old World screwworm. The reason I say this is because the New World screwworm is in very, very low densities in the environment. Even in areas where we mass release the sterile flies, you still don't see them in the environment. Super, super low numbers. Whereas the Old World screwworm is commonly found in the environment. The big difference is that Old World screwworm will impact animals that are already dead. Whereas the New World screwworm impacts animals that are alive. And you can have both of them actually infesting the same animal. And so what happens is she will lay eggs on a wound area. And this is really important, right? This is not like foot and mouth disease where everybody's at equal risk of getting it. If you have a herd and only 1% of those have a wound, that's the 1% that's at risk. Your rest of your animals are quite fine. So we really want to pay attention to those wounds. The females will only mate once in their lifetime, whereas the male will mate multiple times. And this is why we have a sterile insect technique that we'll talk about. So here she is laying her eggs on the wound, and she can lay hundreds and hundreds of eggs. Then these eggs, and here you can see another egg batch here, these eggs will hatch out and they will burrow down into that wound. And the more maggots that come, the more that wound increases in size and depth, and it gets pretty bad. And here you can kind of see we've got all different colors and sizes and things like that. So our main issue here is that the wounds don't need to be terribly big. Tick bites, other insect bites can cause enough of a wound. Our big issues here are going to be things that we do to the animals ourselves, right? If we're dehorning, if we're hot branding, if we're doing castrations, even things like birth trauma, you know, these are things that cause wounds and we need to be careful of those. Intact mucous membranes can also be targeted, so eyes, mouth, vulvas, things like that, but it's fairly rare. And then what happens is this little maggot burrows down into the tissue, and what you get is you get this sort of exudate. It's like a clear straw color, sometimes there's blood mixed in it, and this has a very distinctive smell. So we've been told, I personally haven't smelt it because, you know, we don't have it, but it's like the smell of death, right? So you want to keep a nose open for these things. And this is kind of what it looks like. So here you can see the sort of stuff that's weeping out of the wound, and here's the maggots in here. After that, it will pupate, it will drop to the ground, and it will pupate and then develop into an adult fly. If you suspect an infestation, this is what it's going to look like. It's going to look like you're going to see maggots in a wound. It's like stereotypical. Now, if you see an animal with maggots in a wound, don't immediately panic, right? There's lots of other fly species that can do that. However, if you do see it, we need to notify the state veterinarian. Animals will be lethargic. They're just miserable. I mean, they're getting eaten by maggots. They're just not happy and healthy. They can also rub and lick the affected area. And if we do have high concentrations, the animal can die. This fly will attack anything that is warm-blooded, which means domestic animals, livestock, wildlife, everything is at risk. We need to keep a close eye on our pets, especially if they're traveling. We had an outbreak in 2016 to 2018 in the Florida Keys. We dealt with it just fine. We released sterile flies, everything cleared up. But the reason why there was the outbreak in the Key deer is because there was a dog that traveled and came back with a maggot and probably lost a few along the way, and the veterinarian didn't report it. And so if we had known at that time, we could have released the flies earlier and then there would never have been an outbreak. Humans can be hosts, but it's fairly rare. Why I think that we'll be okay here in Kansas, there's a number of reasons why. This fly is a warm, loving fly, much like myself. I get grumpy when it's cold outside. This fly gets very grumpy when it's cold outside. If your winter temperatures fall below 46 degrees, the fly cannot survive year round. It will automatically kill any fly. So what we have here are there are pockets on the sort of southern United States where the fly can survive all year round, but that's not most of the United States. In Kansas, the fly cannot survive all year round. Even if it reestablishes, this will only be a summer issue for us. Every winter, we reset back down to baseline. So this is why states like Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico are a little bit more worried about it than we necessarily are here in Kansas. So what happens is if the fly keeps coming up and establishes in these areas where we can overwinter, what you will have is each summer the fly populations will explode up and they may come up as high as Kansas, but then each winter it's going to go back down, right? So we're pretty lucky where we are. I took a look. We have this great, 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 great old extension report. So this is the first extension entomologist that Kansas had. And he has these reports, and he did plants, he did humans, he did animals, he did the whole gamut. And I went through these reports, and I tried to find every time he talked about screwworm, because I wanted to know, okay, when it was here, prior to eradication, how bad was it? And only 2 to 2.5% of the animal population was impacted, right? So like I said, this is not something that's going to impact everybody, it's going to be specific animals. Things are a little bit different now, right? Like we have a lot more wildlife. They think that the white-tailed deer populations have exploded because we don't have New World screwworm. New World screwworm really, really is damaging to white-tailed deer, and we think that because we got rid of it, our white-tailed deer really just flourished. We're moving cattle like we have never before, right? Like this, it's going to impact animal movement. So really, biggest risks of introduction is movement of animals during summer, right? If we bring in stockers, if we bring in cattle from the south, things like that, one of those may have it. Then it establishes a local population and we get some spread, but that will really, really just go away. If it establishes in southern states, and this is a big if, you may get natural expansion into Kansas annually, but it's going to be at a low rate. So we're fairly lucky. We have a wonderful, wonderful tool. This is a sterile insect technique. Basically, because those females only mate once, if you raise a whole lot of flies in the lab and you sterilize them, they can outcompete the wild flies and it will crash your population. And this is what we have. Right now, all our flies are being reared in Panama, but we are the new American screwworm facility got opened up. It's going to take them a while to get up and running. Flies are not easy to, when they're like, oh, we'll have it up and running in a year. I was like, I don't know. Flies are tricky, right? You've got to get everything just right for them to be happy. But we do have a facility now, and we are on the road to this. There have been no cases on U.S. soil. Right, so that's the first important thing to remember. You can go to the APHIS website and you can actually track where this is. This is an old map, but this is where you see the green is where they're releasing the flies. They've now moved this up here, so they're now removing the flies in this area. And then we have our new facility up there. So what is important to notice, right? So if we look down here, there's like thousands of cases here. Here's 1,982, 615. This is the area where the fly is, right? High numbers of cases. Do you guys remember the news late last year? There was like, oh no, the fly is now 350 miles from the US border. And then like, oh no, it's now 70 miles from the US border. And everybody panicked. These two things were those big jumps. But there's only two cases, and active cases zero, one case, and it's still active, right? When you see these big jumps, that's not the fly expanding its population. That's an animal that got on a truck. When it got to its destination, they were like, oh, there's maggots in a wound. We can take care of that. We can treat that animal. Everything's good. So even in the news, when you see these big jumps and they start to be a little bit scary, take a look at the map. Like, you can type in aphis screwworm map and you can see this map. And if it's a low number of cases, chances are it's animal movement. If we do have an outbreak, number one, I want to say we are super lucky with who we have as our state veterinarians. These guys are on top of things. They are phenomenal. I speak to my colleagues in other states and they're like, our veterinarians don't know what they're doing. So we are super, super lucky in who we have. This is a foreign animal disease, which means we need to report it. This is so, so important because it's the only way we'll be able to control it. Each state has their own response plans, but they're moving fairly similar, right? They are committed to continuity of business. They want to make sure that we can get cattle safely from Oklahoma and we can safely send our cattle on to Nebraska or Montana or wherever. Why is reporting so critical? Each one of those females can lay 800 eggs, which means that we can go from a fairly controllable situation to out of control very, very quickly, right? There's a very, very short generation time. We want to be able to release those flies over the smallest geographic area possible. And if we don't report it, it'll expand, and then it makes it so much harder to control. So if you see something funny, if you see maggots in an animal, firstly, don't panic, right? There is a game plan for this. You just call up your veterinarian or the state veterinarian. They will send somebody out. I normally tell people this, although I don't think this crowd is necessarily at a problem. We had a case where a veterinarian had a video that they took of an animal that had maggots in a wound, and they said, okay, turn the animal over, and they checked the navel, and there were wounds in maggots in the navel, and he says, oh yeah, you've got it. You can hear him say it on the video. This got shared. This was in Oklahoma on a Friday. They shut everything down. At no point in the video did the veterinarian say, this animal is dead already. Right? So we've got to be really, really careful about taking videos and sharing videos and things like that, because we can cause panic when there doesn't need to be panic. If you do have an animal that has this, don't let it leave the premises. You want to isolate it and secure it. Call your state veterinarian. They will do everything for you. This is kind of like we don't need to do this right now, right? If it comes in later, or if you're bringing in animals from out of state, this is more of a topic. But if this does establish, we're going to want to keep things like 70% ethanol, a sealable tube, a Sharpie in our vehicles. Because if you're driving around, you're like, oh, that animal has maggots in the wound. And you're like, oh, but I've got nothing to collect it in. Let me drive back to the house and get it and come back and try and find that animal again. Right? So start thinking about, what do I need to have if this happens? They're going to collect maggots. We want to collect maggots of all different shapes and sizes. And so they're going to send somebody out to do this, but you can double check them. Be like, hey, are you collecting all different shapes and sizes? Because sometimes the training isn't always very good. You want different shapes and sizes, right? Because if you're only collecting the smallest maggots, these wounds start smelling so bad that flies that usually like dead things will lay their eggs in there. So try and collect a wide range of samples. After collecting them, kill everything, right? You do not want any of those maggots alive. I don't care if you burn them, you freeze them, you dunk them in ethanol, but they've all got to be dead. And then the most important thing is cleaning and disinfecting that wound, because if there are any other flies in the environment, we don't want to recolonize. We can use doramectin as a, it's got emergency approval for treatment, which is great, because if we do have it, we can treat for it. However, I don't want people to be scared now and like, oh no, new world screwworm's coming, I'm just going to treat my whole herd just in case. This is, we're not panicking about this, we're making good decisions. There's some insecticides that we do have that have been licensed for screwworm use. The problem is that we eradicated this, and then all the research into it and all the labeling, just they're like, well, I'm not going to label my product for screwworm because we don't have screwworm. Now the problem is most of our products aren't labeled for use for screwworm, even though they could be used. And so all these companies are now putting in the paperwork to get their products approved. That's screwworm in a nutshell, right? So far, we don't have to panic. Everything's going to be just fine. We will, if things change, be sure we will come back out and tell you all the new information about how to panic about it. But for now, we're not panicking. Any questions? And you guys can feel free to reach out anytime about anything tick fly related.
When we had it before, how much of the country did it cover? Is that what we had in Nebraska when I was a little kid?
Yeah, yeah. It went way up north. There were even cases of it up in Montana. But again, it's like we had it going up that high, but it wasn't as much of an issue as it was down south. Like down south, any animal who had a wound, they had to like go out and check, you know, calves and things like that. And for us, it was not as much of a big deal. It did happen, but the proportion of it, the scale of it wasn't as high. We would have years where we didn't have it at all. What there was an indication, there was a strong association in his notes that he had. When we had outbreaks, it was when we had bought feeder cattle from the south. And it was always associated with these feeder cattle coming in from the south. If we have an annual sort of influx, it's going to be at a super low level. Our big concern is cattle coming in from the south. And there's movement restrictions. And KDA has a whole big thing about there's this location and then there's like different zones and things like that. And it's all to limit animal spread. If we can keep the animals contained, we can at least minimize it. What we don't have control over is the livestock, right? The deer. So how well this animal movement restriction is gonna work. They did show a KDA showed a slide where basically in Texas, the last time they had an outbreak, a big outbreak in the 70s, they didn't have animal restriction, and they showed that how a couple of years later, how the just number of cases increased significantly. And they think that's because they didn't have animal restrictions, so it spread a lot more. So we'll have to see. But my gut tells me that we'll get this under control before it ever becomes an issue for us here in Kansas. It's my hope, at least. I have great faith in entomologists.
So is the old world screwworm not planted?
Yep. Yep. We have it around. Different species, looks very similar. The only difference is that the one has a stripe, like the only visual difference, and it's not terribly useful because it's only like, and as entomologists, we do this all the time, and it's not very useful. The new world one, the stripe goes up to about here. The old one, the stripe goes right up to the top. That's the visual difference. Now, that's only useful if you've seen them side by side. But yeah, that's the visual. But we can when we put out traps for this, we get 90% that, right? Like they're just so present in the environment. And that's part of the problem with the surveillance is that, yeah, we can put out traps and surveil for it, but 99.9% of what we catch is bycatch. And so so somebody's having to sit there saying, not screwworm, not screwworm, not screwworm, not screwworm, not screwworm, not screwworm. And so it's difficult to trap them in the environment and get a good idea. Anything else?